6. A Dog's Tale. Terry Hodson, Family Man, 2001 to 2004. Terry Hodson was a doting grandfather who loved his wife's home cooking. He and Christine had been teenage sweethearts and came from the same Staffordshire village. Their East Kew home, just down the road from the Harp Road police station, was filled with family photos. A BMW gleamed in their garage. There were many BMWs in this wealthy nook of Melbourne's East, but not so many gun-toting drug dealers. Terry Hodson was a survivor. He'd left school at 14 and met Christine when he was on a worksite. Later, he'd run a car yard, but ended up in jail when a deal went sour. He'd escaped and eventually moved to Melbourne, and now, in his 50s, veered towards Arthur Daly stylings. He thrived on scotch and coke. Cocaine, that is. He nicknamed his grandson Villain, and his gun, Roscoe. Two of his children, Mandy and Andrew, sold drugs for him. Cops liked him, even when they were charging him. Chrissy, as cops called her, was a devoted wife. If you didn't know who they were, you'd think, well, they're quite nice people, an investigator would tell Dowsley and Carlyon. Hodson was small time compared with the drug barons he informed against. He was mostly unknown past the TAB pub a few hundred metres from his home, until he was executed, that is, alongside Chrissy in front of the TV in May 2004. Ex-Chief Commissioner Christine Nixon agreed in 2011 that their killings remained the greatest stain on Victoria Police's reputation, and one of the saddest unsolved mysteries. Not many murders boast so many facts and so few answers. The longer story of the Hodson killings has taken years to be told. Even now, their case, like any that involves Nicola Gobbo, flounders in conflicting notions that muddle the obvious starting points. Dowsley and Carlyon have spent countless hours holding the details of the Hodson case up to the light. They feel deeply for the Hodson children, who relied on Dowsley to fill them in on Gobbo's proximity to their parents in life and in death. The two Hodson daughters, Mandy and Nikki, are grateful to Dowsley for his unfettered pursuit of the truth. He, like the fictional LA detective Harry Bosch, has a singular approach. Everybody counts or nobody counts. The Hodsons weren't clean, but they were a loving family. It happened to the Hodsons, but it could have happened to any of us. It is an involved story. The following is intended to guide the reader through the murk. In the Hodson vortex, some of the cops were the crooks, and the crooks were the victims. The informer informed on his informer handlers. The informer who became the victim was under protection when a police officer was suspected of having him killed. The police officer's murder charge was dropped when a witness against him was killed in protection. Make sense? It's not supposed to. No one except the killer or killers know or knows what happened. The Hodson case featured more double crosses than a sewing bee, and plenty of stitch-ups. Nothing was as it appeared, largely because the loudest voices in this tragedy would almost all be discredited. Nicola Gobbo was prominent among them. This tale began when two of the Hodson children, Andrew and Mandy, were charged with drug offences in 2001. Mandy, nicknamed Dimples by her father, had discovered hard drugs on her 23rd birthday when Terry gave her speed. He turned police informer to help his kids. He couldn't bear the thought of his daughter in a prison cell. Terry Hodson, informer 4/390, was handled by Detective Senior Constable David Michel, who had arrested Andrew and Mandy. Michel would soon be working under Detective Sergeant Paul Dale at the Major Drug Investigation Division, MDID. Nothing about Dale said average, except his country upbringing playing footy and dreaming of bright lights in Yackandandah in Victoria's north. Hodson later told police that Dale was always complaining about a lack of money. Dale denies he once asked Hodson for a gun, as Hodson claimed, and for ecstasy pills so he could try them with his girlfriend. Dale was thought of as a charmer, a man's man and a ladies man too. He was always good for a beer with both cops and crooks. He wasn't an elite detective, but he was pretty cunning. Dave Michel sported a ponytail and rode a motorbike. As a kid on the Murray River, he hung out with the nerds at school. The first surprise for classmates was when he grew up to be a detective. A bigger shock was when he turned out to be a dirty one, when asked, "What's the best advice or motto to live by?" On a school reunion questionnaire, Michel wrote, "Deny, deny, deny, demand proof." Michel has since been dismissed as a corrupt cop who ignored Chief Commissioner Christine Nixon's clean sweep missive. The embodiment of greed and deceit, Michel is now thought to have threatened, harassed, and profited for years under the cover of a police badge. Michel was secretive in ways that put fellow officers off. He was especially secretive about his love interest, Mandy Hodson. Obviously, he shouldn't have been sleeping with a suspect who was also the daughter of his informer. The lines got even more blurred. In return for informing, Terry Hodson was allowed to deal drugs from his home. He basically had a green light to break the law. Police superiors knew Michel was too close to the Hodsons. The other Hodson daughter, Nikki Komiasik, knew it too. She says that when her partner, Peter Reed, was about to be raided at home, Michel tipped her off beforehand. Terry Hodson's relationship with his handlers breached virtually every tenet of informer management. Informer misuse, incompetence, and the withholding of intelligence from other police would all fuel the Hodson tragedy ahead. The state of Victoria still owes the Hodson kids the truth, if not more. The system failed their parents. Those who played outside of the rules have never been held to account. The Hodson scandal has been told many times, but no telling has properly included Gobbo's place in it, until now. Her role in events before and after the killings defies the sympathy that might apply elsewhere in her story. A naive manipulator doomed to regret her improper proximity to the Hodson killings? This is the kindest possible take on Gobbo's role, and it's probably too kind. Terry Hodson was a prolific informer. He ratted out his enemies and his customers and his friends. Like Gobbo, he treated informing as a game. Not that his targets wanted to play. Take Carl Lyon's suburban cricket teammate, a former private school kid who turned to drug dealing. He was picked up in a freeway chase after he bought thousands of ecstasy pills from Hodson, took legal advice from Nicola Gobbo, and spent several years in a country prison thanks to his friend Hodson, who had snitched on him. High demand for pills meant good times for Hodson. But he grew addicted to the adrenaline of his double life. When the MDID could not find $20,000 so he could make an undercover purchase of pills, he paid for the drugs himself. That he later sold the pills at great profit suggests the glaring deficiencies of police oversight at the time. Yet Hodson's enthusiasm for informing also endangered him. Even nobodies like Carl Lyon's drug-dealing cricket mate expressed a desire to kill him. Hodson's informer number kept turning up in police briefs against the drug criminals. Nicola Gobbo, who worked for many of the accused, figured out that informer 4/390 was Hodson. She fished for information from Michel outside court one day, and her curiosity prompted an urgent informer number change. But identifying the exact starting point of Hodson's collision course with death is fraught. The prevailing version of events is based on Hodson's own words to anti-corruption police. His story implicates Paul Dale, who was charged with several crimes but never convicted of any. Dale has always maintained his innocence. Hodson would speak to police of a chicken salad lunch with his handlers Dale and Michelle at Romeo's, an Italian restaurant in Uppity Toorak, on the 8th of September 2003. There, he alleged, the trio conjured up plans to burgle an illegal drug storage house in Dublin Street, East Oakley, a suburb in Melbourne's southeast. Dale, Michelle, and Hodson purchased burner phones under false names to communicate. It would be an easy job, Hodson said he was told, because Dale's police unit had the drug residents under surveillance. The burglary stank of diabolical perfection. The burglars knew what was in the house and when it would be unoccupied. They knew the gaps in the police oversight because they were the oversight. On the night of the burglary, the 27th of September 2003, Melbourne was distracted. Earlier that day, the Brisbane Lions had won the AFL flag for the third time in a row. Three previous burglary attempts had been aborted because tenants were home. Though Dale had turned up on these earlier occasions, according to Hodson, he pulled out on the night it actually took place, supposedly because he was tied up with guests at home. As a result, Hodson said, he and Michelle squabbled about Dale's cut. That night, Hodson was buzzing after snorting cocaine from a vial he was carrying. One suspects he always carried a vial. He and Michelle basted themselves in Stop dog repellent to deter the guard dog in the house and lit cigarettes for the police surveillance camera, hoping this might throw off investigators later, as neither smoked. Michelle, dressed in black, smashed the front light and charged the front door with his shoulder. A neighbour heard the breaking glass and called police. The pair rushed into different rooms of the house and rifled through drawers and cupboards. Hodson saw a blinking light in a bedroom and fretted that a silent alarm had been tripped. But the burglars appeared to be in luck. They grabbed plastic bags stuffed with drugs and cash. To this day, controversy swirls around the size of the haul. One of the drug tenants alleged that $750,000 cash was taken. It remains unaccounted for, leading to suggestions that Michelle never admitted any wrongdoing because he knew he would receive a cut of the massive takings later on. They tossed bags of drugs over the back fence of the property before separating, then met at a nearby school and watched a police car cruise by. Hodson correctly assumed that someone had heard the disturbance and notified the police. Michelle dashed back to get the stash. Here, it all went wrong. Despite the dog repellent, Michelle was bitten on the arse by police dog Silky after he was found up a tree. Hodson gave himself up when a police dog rushed him in his nearby hiding place. Police later described the burglary arrests as a triumph of neighbourhood watch. They were also a new low in a flourishing chapter of Victoria police corruption. Michelle's dog bite led to a limp and warranted a trip in an ambulance and skin graft operations. He rang Dale after his arrest with an Ambo's phone. Dale's movements over these first hours and weeks after the burglary would be probed for years to come. Dale turned up later the same night at room 104 of the Freemasons Hospital in Melbourne's Inner East, not far from the MCG and its surrounding pubs filled with sad Collingwood fans. His visit to Michelle's bedside was unsanctioned and unsupervised. He rang his superior, MDID head and later Piranha Task Force leader, Detective Senior Sergeant Jim O'Brien, at 9:32 p.m. O'Brien would say in 2019 that he thought Dale's explanation of events sounded like rubbish. Dale went straight from the hospital to the MDID offices on the 12th floor of the St Kilda Road police complex. Investigators came to believe, and Dale later denied, that while there, he stole a confidential dossier that became known as the Blue File. The Blue File contained 31 of Hodson's information reports to police. There were many blue files at the MDID, stuffed into a clutter of safes and filing cabinets. Yet security was so poor that the office cleaner could have lifted a file from one of the unlocked filing cabinets. Hodson's highly protected blue file, which contained the names of those he had betrayed, was soon circulating throughout the underworld. No one else bar Dale had reason to pinch the file, investigators later argued. Its possession offered Dale leverage against Hodson. Dale had the opportunity to steal the blue file and, if he was involved in the break-in, he had a motive to do so. Retired Judge Tony Fitzgerald QC would argue in a 2005 report on behalf of the Victorian Office of Police Integrity. Fitzgerald would find no evidence that any other person did so or any sufficient basis for suspecting any other person. Dale was left out of a departmental crisis meeting on the Monday, 2 days after the burglary. Then he was seen at his desk, ripping pages out of his police daybook. Forensic tests later showed he rewrote the entries in his daybook for the 27th of September, the night of the burglary. Dale took lengthy sick leave in the week afterward. He was in the frame for the burglary, and he knew it. He would fight for his job for years, but within months of the burglary, he was working on a construction site. The once decorated detective was now digging ditches. Terry Hodson, meanwhile, was considering his options. He had been caught red-handed at the Dublin Street burglary, but there was an out. He could snitch on dirty cops and save himself a long jail sentence. He took a tentative step towards cooperating with detectives by leading them to Michelle's motorbike in the post-dawn hours after the burglary. He hinted at a willingness to help, but he needed a lawyer. Inspector Peter DeSanto of the Police Ethical Standards Department, ESD, found one for him, Nicola Gobbo. DeSanto had the thrusting obstinacy of an old-time corruption buster. He knew Gobbo well. 2 years earlier, Gobbo had represented Andrew Hodson over charges of drug dealing and armed robbery. DeSanto had spoken to Andrew and Gobbo about corrupt officers within the drug squad. He wanted to talk to Gobbo again, now that Andrew's father was embroiled in the Dublin Street burglary. He and Gobbo had stayed in touch. When DeSanto had sought secret information in the intervening years, he'd called her, and she had provided it. Their chats had constituted another unofficial instance of Gobbo's informing. Wayne Strawhorn, Stuart Bateson, and DeSanto, the detective investigating Strawhorn. DeSanto scared her, she would say in 2019. He was a master of deception who gathered insights like moving chess pieces. He was not a bully, she told the Royal Commission. He would do it in a very professional way, but he was, conniving is probably the best way to put it. He was a scary bloke. A few days after the Dublin Street burglary, DeSanto called Gobbo to get to Andrew, to get to his father. He wanted Terry Hodson's evidence. He needed the informer turned burglar to inform on his police handlers, Michelle and Dale. Within a week, Hodson implicated Dale as a co-conspirator in the burglary. Either Hodson was recounting a detailed version of true events, or he was a very good liar. Police accepted his account. DeSanto was just doing his job, and doing it thoroughly. Yet DeSanto's choice of Gobbo as Hodson's lawyer had already triggered deceits that would culminate in Hodson's death. By the time Hodson officially named Dale as a big-time burglar, Dale was pursuing a budding friend and drinking partner, Nicola Gobbo. Dale and Gobbo were once foes. They had first become acquainted through courtroom tussles. Gobbo once excoriated Dale in the witness box in a display of belligerence so pronounced it was reported in the newspapers. They were on poor terms. Until one night when, according to Dale, they drank with a group at a South Melbourne pub before the crowd piled into her Mercedes coupe and went to the casino. In the aftermath of the Dublin Street burglary, Gobbo positioned herself at the centre of the conflicting agendas of Dale and DeSanto. She was playing both sides. Whoever won the battle stood to gain the critical prize of Terry Hodson's loyalty. The devil shelters in the details, and what happened next is involved. To this day, it remains unclear why Gobbo interfered the way she did, and whose side she was on. Let's retrace the steps. On Sunday, the morning after the burglary, Dale rang Gobbo about Adam, Ahmed, who oversaw the drug house operation, Abby Haynes, the drug house sitter, and Colleen O'Reilly, a drug mule who had all been arrested by Dale's crew. They wanted to talk to Gobbo about representing them. On Tuesday, DeSanto rang Gobbo. He had a job for his unofficial informer. She already had intelligence for him. Hodson had intimated to her that Dale was involved. On Wednesday, she met with Terry and Andrew Hodson at the Celtic Club in Melbourne's legal precinct, pretending to act as a lawyer, but in fact, acting as a police agent. As Andrew Hodson would recall later, Gobbo was fishing for information from his father. Terry Hodson's paranoia was high, and he appeared stoned. Her notes of the meeting reiterated her earlier intelligence about Dale. She was told Dale was off, corrupt, as was the drug squad hierarchy. On Saturday, Hodson rang DeSanto. He had received an anonymous phone call. He believed the caller was Dale. Hodson was urged to stick together with Dale and Michelle. There was no need to get into bed with anyone, and the caller promised, "You'll be looked after." Hodson took the call as a coded warning not to roll on Dale. Hodson told DeSanto something else, too, that the blonde lady, Gobbo, is sleeping with the three striper, Sergeant Paul Dale. On the 9th of October, while her client engaged with ethical standards investigators, Gobbo accepted a drinks invitation from Dale. They went to O'Connell's, a South Melbourne pub, and got blind drunk. She brought along a file of criminal conspiracy cases because he was fretting about his situation. There was a lustful attraction that night, Gobbo would later admit, coupled with paranoia. Dale feared that she was wearing a wire. They kissed at the bar before going home together. She blacked out, but she said that this night was the first time they slept together. Here's the question. Why would she meet a cop who had arrested her clients from the Oakley drug house and was also a suspect in stealing from them? Worse, why would she sleep with a man Terry Hodson, her latest client, had told her was off? She knew that Hodson was providing evidence to DeSanto that could jail Dale for a decade or more. Gobbo had no good reason to catch up with Dale, but lots of bad ones. They kept catching up, on and off, for years. When Gobbo and Dale got together for a second time, about 3 weeks after the burglary, over coffee, Dale diarised the meeting as a catch-up with his lawyer. She would describe the meeting in a 2009 statement to police as an attempt by Dale to glean information about what Hodson had revealed to police. Police came to believe that her assessment was correct. Paul spoke to me and was desperate to find out whether Terry had made a statement implicating Paul in the burglary. Gobbo would say, "I didn't know, and I told Paul this. I did not inform Paul about my contact with ESD on Terry's behalf." She would tell police she had advised Dale to get an Orange brand phone, which investigators believed was code for a burner phone, in October 2003. Gobbo's statement would not describe the nature of her catch-ups with Dale after the first entirely social meeting in October, or explain why she and Dale used burner phones. Hers, given to her by drug house client Adam Ahmed and registered under Russian names. This was another red flag. Lawyers should never need to use burner phones, Their client conversations, overheard or not, are privileged and cannot be used in evidence. Anyone using a burner phone, from criminals to cheaters, has bad motives for doing so. Gobbo's conflicts were outrageous. She was Hodson's lawyer at the behest of Victoria Police. She was volunteering to be Dale's legal advisor, thereby endangering Hodson. She was also the lawyer for all of the criminals who ran the Oakley Drug House, Adam Ahmed, Abby Haynes, and Colleen O'Reilly. Behind them was Gobbo's biggest client of all, Tony Mockbell. She could not serve this spread of clients without compromising the interests of some of them. In hindsight, it seems remarkable that these conflicts were not identified by a judge or professional body at the time. Gobbo appeared free to make up the rules as she went, and she would continue to do so in the years ahead. Hodson, too, was making it up as he went along. He was a con man, and you can't con a con man. He talked to Gobbo, whom he dubbed the Big Lady, to try to get messages through to Dale, whom he feared. Hodson is thought to have worn a wire under his white overalls for a meeting with Gobbo at Domino's Cafe in the city's legal district on the 30th of October. Gobbo would recall that Hodson offered her cash and cocaine during the chat. Nothing much came of it. Gobbo saw DeSanto by chance on the 4th of November at the Melbourne Cup, where the Flemington crowd topped 120,000. In the members' enclosure champagne bar, soon after Maccabi Diva won the race, Gobbo fed DeSanto allegations that Dale and Hodson were trafficking prior to the Dublin Street incident. Gobbo's choices did not make sense. She was speaking more and more to Dale on burner phones, and she was teasing his would-be nemesis, DeSanto, with incriminating claims about him. A few weeks later, Gobbo chased Dale for a drink for her birthday. She met him on another night to quell his paranoia. He feared criminal charges, but Gobbo would say that Dale also feared that Tony Mockbell might kill him first over the stolen drugs. On the 5th of December 2003, after 2 months of fretting, Dale, Michelle and Hodson were arrested and charged with the Dublin Street burglary. Victoria Police, with Hodson's detailed evidence, were ready to present a case against two of their own. Although Hodson was cutting a deal, Gobbo was still meddling. She visited Dale in prison soon after his arrest, and again a week later. She would tell police in 2009 that the second visit was the only time she spoke to Dale in a strictly professional capacity. Yet she exchanged documents with Dale in the coming weeks after he got bail. He gave her his hand-up brief, the evidence gathered against him by investigators. In return, she provided him with the hand-up briefs of her other clients in the case, Adam Ahmed, Abby Haynes, and Colleen O'Reilly. She later said that she wanted to help her clients through these exchanges, and that Dale agreed to this. Why would Dale want to assist scumbag drug suspects? They were comparing notes to find the investigation flaws. She later told investigators that during the prison visits, Dale said he wanted to see Carl Williams and Tony Mockbell. So much for Dale's right to confidentiality from a professional legal advisor. Williams loomed in the background. For Gobbo was also fraternizing with her other big client in this catastrophe of impropriety. Investigators would accuse Dale of dabbling in the dark side from 2001 by courting a Williams associate so he could get to Williams, who then paid Dale for tip-offs. Paul Dale still says he knew nothing of the Dublin Street burglary plot, though he has never explained the absence of specialist surveillance police at the location of the house on the weekend when it was burgled. He wrote an outraged autobiography about a wronged cop in 2013. The book was a potted tale. He overlooked his use of burner phones, which he said in court were for extramarital affairs, But the fact remains that Dale is a free man and has never been convicted of a single crime. In statements from 2007, most of which police were able to corroborate, Williams would claim a relationship with Dale dating back to 2002. He said that he and Dale walked laps in an inner northern Melbourne public pool to avoid eavesdropping police. A decade later, George Williams would support his son's claim in open court. Dale, of course, has denied any improper links with either Carl Williams or Tony Mockbell, and police have never proven them. Gobbo's 2009 statement to police did not explain why she helped Dale communicate with Williams in the months preceding the Hodgsons' deaths. In her statement, she described a catch-up on the 2nd of May 2004. Phone records would show that Gobbo and Dale tried to communicate 46 times that day. Gobbo fished Dale out of one Richmond pub and they went to another. He rang Carl Williams 4 times from 9:36 p.m. He got through to George Williams and said, "Tell Carl to ring Nicola. He's a fucking useless prick." Gobbo met with Williams on the 5th of May at Cafe Martini in Lonsdale Street. The meeting was observed by detectives, but they couldn't know that Gobbo was passing on a message. Dale wanted Williams to call him. Williams would say in 2007 that he called Dale's burner phone from a payphone at the Water Gardens shopping centre the next day. The fact of the call would be verified by police. The pair were thought to meet later that day in the northwest Melbourne suburb of Hillside. This was just 9 days before the Hodgsons were killed. Dale would deny the meeting took place. Police would retrace George Williams's car, which had a tracker on it, to a location near Dale's temporary place of work on a construction site, supporting Williams's 2007 assertions. According to Williams, he and Dale walked near a building site. Dale told Williams that he had hired a hitman to kill Terry Hodgson sometime earlier, but the job had not been done. Dale needed Hodgson dead before Hodgson testified against him for the Dublin Street burglary. Williams agreed to arrange a replacement hitman for $150,000. The chat ended when Dale went to pick up one of his children from daycare or kindergarten. The next day, Williams contacted Rodney Collins, the ghastliest of killers for hire. Even photos of Collins give off a stench. Bystanders were sometimes also killed during his paid hits, loose ends to be dispatched. Collins tended to kill the partners of the men he was hired to hit, in a kind of two-for-one zeal. When he went to kill Dorothy Abbey in her lounge room in 1987 after murdering her husband, he found he had run out of bullets, so he used a kitchen knife to slash her throat. Later that day, Williams and Collins caught up at a city restaurant, Windows. Tony Mockbell, sporting a cap, joined the group. His presence here represents another direct link to the Hodgson story. Police would determine that it was Mockbell who distributed the blue file allegedly stolen by Paul Dale to gangland figures on the 28th of February 2004. And they would theorise that Mockbell had received it from Nicola Gobbo. Police discovered that the blue file was faxed from Taiba Stables, linked to Mockbell, to underworld figure Mark Smith in Queensland. Dale had caught up with Gobbo in February. He talked to Williams on Gobbo's phone on the 27th of February 2004, and a phone call between Gobbo and Mockbell was later said to have been intercepted by the Australian Federal Police that same month. During that call, Gobbo supposedly told Mockbell that their mutual friend Pauline had been in touch about documents for Mockbell. Victoria Police would come to believe that Pauline was Paul Dale, and that the documents were the blue file. Of course, Dale maintains his innocence and says that he was set up by Williams and other criminals to whom lying is second nature. The Gobbo-Mockbell phone intercept was vital. In a submission for a coronial inquest into the Hodgsons' deaths 10 years after they were killed, police argued that the phone call and Mockbell's possession of the blue file confirmed the nefarious motives of a dirty cop. Their theory implied that, in handing over the blue file to Mockbell, Gobbo had knowingly endangered her client, Terry Hodgson. Victoria Police would say they only became aware of the AFP intercepted recording in 2010, 6 years after it took place. And here's something stranger. Investigators couldn't get their evidence straight. At the coronial inquest's conclusion, Victoria Police withdrew the purported Gobbo Mockbell phone call as evidence. They would argue, using logic lifted from Monty Python, that there was now no evidence that this evidence existed. One investigator was adamant that the phone call had taken place. Another detective was equally convinced that it had not. It may exist or it may not, but it has never been produced. The Hodgson children say police never told their father that the blue file, containing the information reports laying bare his numerous betrayals of hardened criminals, was handed out to the very people he betrayed. Even if Dale didn't want him dead, plenty of others did. Gobbo has denied she passed it on, but the dreadful truth was that the document doubled as a death sentence after it was stolen from MDID officers and delivered to Tony Mockbell. What we don't know is how it got there. Hodgson never knew the size of the bullseye on the back of his head, or that his own lawyer had linked herself into the chain of his demise. In December 2003, soon after he was charged, he had left Gobbo for another lawyer, Dowsley's friend Rob Starry, who secured a deal in which Hodgson would serve no jail time for the Dublin Street burglary in exchange for rolling on Dale and Michelle. Hodgson then inexplicably took back Gobbo, the meddler he did not trust, as his legal representative before April 2004. This decision was one of his last.